Back in the 1980s, I chanced to find Chris Reynolds' comics in the British comics anthology magazine Escape. I say chanced because in those days, the distribution of comics from across the ocean to North America was pretty random. It was pure luck to have found them. I was immediately drawn to his comics. They were odd comics, but they were very beautifully drawn. They were odd comics because they appeared to be in some sort of science fiction world, but the details were sort of vague. The characters' motivations were kind of vague as well. And in fact, the characters were sort of vague. You didn't know where you stood while you were reading them. But that said, there was a mystery sort of inherent in the work that was instantly compelling. Something deeply spiritual seemed to be going on under the surface. I found them fascinating. I spent the next decade trying to track down all of Reynolds' comics, a very difficult task pre-internet. In fact, even with the internet, it was pretty much impossible to do. I only completed the set once I got into direct contact with Chris himself. I've consistently reread these comics time and again, and consistently remained fully engaged with them. In 2005, I wrote an appreciation of Mauritania Comics, his comics, for the Comics Journal, and that let people know how much I liked them. In the decade following that, I was approached a couple of times about potentially putting together a collection of Chris's work, but sadly, each time those plans sort of fell through. When Lucas Adams of New York Review Comics approached me last year about editing and designing the book, I was extremely ready. I think the comics in it are wonderful. I hope you will think so too. Chris and I have only met for about a moment, and we've never even spoken before today, so I think it'll be interesting to talk to him. Please, everyone welcome the talented Welsh cartoonist, Chris Reynolds.
Thank you, everyone.
Now, is this one on?
Yes.
Okay, so we're just going to talk, and we'll see where it goes. I'm going to start with a very sort of basic question, which is, where do you live, and what is it like there?
I live in Bournemouth, which is on the south coast of England, and it's very pleasant, it has a nice climate, and it's a tourist town, so people are generally happy.
Is this a place, now you're not from there.
I'm not from there, no.
Where you came from Wales originally?
I lived in Wales from my childhood up until I moved away to college.
Okay, and where did you go to college?
I went to college in Stoke-on-Trent, which is in the English Midlands.
Okay, these are all charming English words of which I know nowhere where any of them are. But Stoke-on-Trent is very beautiful and poetic sounding. Was it a nice place?
It depends what you're interested in. It's what they call the potteries. It's where the English porcelain industry was through the 19th century.
And a lot of your work has a very industrial flavor to it. Was it reflected of that place?
Not so much that place, but other places, including places in Wales where I grew up, places where I'd visit my relatives when growing up, and that kind of fascination with the ruined industrial landscape particularly comes from the childhood days.
Was that something you were consciously trying to infuse with the work, or is that just an environment that crept into it because you were familiar with it?
I liked the feel of it. It didn't just come. I thought, I'm having this, you know, and I like the feel, so I'm going to put it in.
Yeah. Well, I think that so much talk about cartooning. It's interesting that people do a lot of analysis of, you know, why the choices you make, and there's a lot of people that talk about all their, you know, planning that goes into it. But I think ultimately, most artists work pretty intuitively, and then later make up a lot of reasons about why they were doing things.
Well, when I read your review of my work in the Comics Journal, that's exactly what I thought. I thought, I didn't know all this stuff I've been doing. Seth has spotted it all. I thought, oh, how does he know? I didn't know all this.
Well,
and then at the end,
myself.
You said that the Penguin Mauritania book completed the Mauritania comics. And I thought, what, should I stop then? And so I kind of didn't stop, but very interesting comments, and it was great to have that appreciation.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I do think that, like, when you look into artists' work, you discover their intentions, even if they didn't know it.
That's exactly the way, yes.
I often feel like when sometimes I'll do a book and then someone will come up to me later and they'll say, like, oh, I really love that very clever thing you did, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then I'll think, but I didn't do that on purpose. It never even occurred to me. That is clever, though. How did that happen? But then I think ultimately it's like you made the book, so your brain made it happen.
And it's very similar to another experience I had where I dreamt about this marvelous comic that somebody else had drawn. And then I woke up and I thought, if only I could write and draw that comic. And I thought, well, whose dream is it then, Chris?
It's funny, I often have the opposite dream. I often wake up and have a fleeting feeling that of a dream that I just had about a big graphic novel that I drew years ago that I have released, and it's terrible.
Oh.
And I think, I always wake up and I'm like, oh God, why did I let that happen? And then, thank God, I wake up for real. But anyhow, I was going to ask you, since we were talking about places where you lived, somehow or other childhood seems very strong in the work, like an image over, especially when you're dealing with like the children themselves, but there's Monitor himself feels like a child, and Jimmy of course is childlike. Is your own childhood like, is that something you're dwelling on? Do you think about your childhood much?
I think about it all the time, and I expect everybody does, even if they don't realize it.
I agree.
You form, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
You become, and so it's natural to kind of have the totality of the experience, including the childhood.
Sometimes, though, it's funny. My wife does not seem to dwell on childhood like as much as I do.
My wife doesn't.
Yeah. See, there you go. Maybe I don't know, but it seems like every cartoonist
I meet
is kind of obsessed with their childhood.
Yeah.
Do you think it's the pop culture nature of comics themselves that you formed, like an attachment to the medium when you're a child, and it keeps that alive?
I definitely did form an attachment to the medium, as you do. And I've always thought this is the best way of doing stories, doing pictures, and presenting experiences for other people to read. It is the best. It's better than films, because you can do it at any speed. You don't need favours or money to get it done. You can just do it. And you don't need to write description, because you can get it exact with the pictures.
You were involved with film, weren't you?
I was. When I was a student, I did lots of Super 8 films. But also, I worked as a commercial filmmaker, making industrial films, also in Stoke-on-Trent when I was a student.
Yeah.
We did films for Esso, for a local leisure centre, and for a company who sent robot cameras down into pipes to find bursts and that kind of thing. Very interesting. But the company was in Stoke-on-Trent, was too small a town to support the company, really. We had competitors there. And so that didn't last. And I moved to London to be with my friends.
Did you like the technical elements of making films?
I did like the technical elements, but the fraught nature of being able to afford to do things and to lug all the huge cameras around in those days kind of spoiled the enjoyment a little bit. Plus, dealing with the clients and editing was very primitive in those days.
I bet.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I think like you tend to meet people who really like technical. I think a lot of cartoonists become cartoonists because all you need is a pencil and a piece of paper.
That's right.
And so it's quite different than like many other mediums where you have to totally learn.
Yeah, there's like, no technical knowledge involved at all. You can just do it.
Yeah. I mean, I started taking photographs in the last few years and I've really enjoyed it. I take a lot of pictures. And then one day I said to myself, maybe I should actually learn how to use this camera properly. So I went and talked to a photographer friend, and he explained to me for about a half an hour, and then I said to myself after that, I said, do I really want to know how to work the camera or not? And I said to myself, I don't. And the answer was, I like taking pictures, I don't like cameras.
Yeah,
and I think that some people like technical stuff.
Yeah.
And that's why I was curious if you were, because there are...
I like technical stuff when there's no... When there's nothing involved about whether you get it right or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like that too.
Yeah.
I mean, when you really got to... It's funny, you know, I think... I don't know, there was a show... the last panel was about multimedia, and I was wondering, can you learn more than one medium in great depth in a lifetime? I don't know. Maybe I'm selling people short.
I think you might be selling people short, but it depends what you're... I think it depends what you're interested in. Do you have the interest to persevere?
Yeah. Might be, and cartoonists do tend to be very single-minded, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you more about comics in that I don't get the impression from the few interviews I've read from you that you were like a super comic enthusiast before you started making them.
No, I like them, but I like lots of things. I like trains, I liked walking, I liked nature. You know, when you're a child, you like all sorts of things. And then you don't like things, you like aeroplanes and then cars. They were never kind of a kind of super intense thing.
Did you draw comics before you started the comics that you were published in Escape and then Mauritania?
Yeah, yeah. Because I drew comics as a child. I drew them when I was a student with my friend Paul Harvey. And it was him that got me started, because when all this moving from Stoke-on-Trent to London happened, he went down there first.
Okay.
And he got a job at Forbidden Planet Comic Shop.
Who was Paul Harvey? I've never really had a clear idea.
He's a friend of mine from college in Stoke-on-Trent. And he went on to become a guitarist with Pauline Murray's band, Penetration, and also is a member of the Stuckist Painters, and is quite well known for his painting.
Oh, okay.
But he started Mauritania Comics, really, because when he moved to Forbidden Planet, he called me up and he said, "Chris, I'm starting a new comic and I want you to do some stories for it."
Okay.
Because we'd done comics together in a kind of student-y way at college. And then he came to visit me, and it came to be that it wasn't going to be his project, it was going to be a joint project, and Mauritania Comics started.
Okay. Now, it seems to me like when I... those Mauritania comics, which were, I guess, basically part of the British zine explosion of the early 80s, like your first... your style in the first issue is a little shaky, and then the second issue it's a little tighter, and then maybe by the third issue it's like super together. It's like, it seemed to me like you had a very quick learning curve there.
Yes, I think I did, because in the first one, some of the stories were in fact a bit older.
Okay.
You know, they were stories that I already had and then put them in because I had them by me.
Yeah.
And I've been doing the same kind of drawing as I ended up doing, but with thinner lines, and then I came across the idea of the thick lines, and more or less that was it, and I'd arrived at the way I like to draw.
It's a very interesting style, because I mean, it immediately evokes woodcuts. That's the first thing I thought, although they don't really look like woodcuts, but what they do have is they have a feeling of being printed. Like there's like a blur quality that you don't seem concerned about clarity, or not clarity, but when you would draw a face, it didn't matter if like things, almost like the details were lost. It's actually, I was quite surprised, you'd rarely see that in comics. You see it occasionally in illustration where people would deliberately use a blurred line or something. But it's remarkable that they do have a quality of film about them somehow.
Well, that's because I think that comes from my interest in Super 8, which is, you know, very colorful, but not very clear.
Mm-hmm. It's actually, when I was working on designing the book, I was loving like looking at the actual panels where you would have like a figure where the eye and the nose might be kind of blurring together the line work. And I was like, this is the kind of thing I would have spent an hour with whiteout correcting. But it is so, it gives a very powerful feel to reading the comics themselves.
Oh, thank you.
Now, I wanted to say, so did you sweat out the details of thinking about your style developing, or did it just happen?
No, it just happened. I thought, oh, that works well enough. I'll carry on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that basically how... were you thinking in terms of deadline at that point? Like, I have to get comics done for the next issue?
No, because we didn't really have deadlines. We set ourselves deadlines. We thought we'd do a comic every 6 months or something. But it's easy to do enough material to fill a comic every 6 months without thinking of deadlines.
Yeah. How old were you back then?
I'd have been 25... up until 32, I think.
Okay.
Doing that first kind of...
yeah, you turned out quite a few issues. I think there was like, what, how many issues of Mauritania?
16 in all.
Okay. Now, did you feel connected to the other British cartoonists who were working at that time?
I kind of knew them. I knew the Escape artists and the Fast Fiction artists, but I never really felt kind of particularly connected to them. And looking back on it, I think perhaps I should have felt a bit more connected.
Yeah.
But I always thought, I've done my own thing. This, you know, I'm with them, but... it's just kind of arm's length, perhaps.
And geographically, were you far enough? Like, did you go and hang out with any of those guys?
Yeah, I used to live in the same house as some of them.
Oh, okay. Well, that's, I was going to say, back in the 80s, like in the world of North American cartoonists, you felt that there was a handful of cartoonists that you felt like were like you were in it together kind of thing. But they were so far away, you don't even see somebody once in a blue moon.
Yeah, but perhaps that helped the feeling of togetherness, that you had to have that kind of...
Yeah.
You had to kind of make that feeling for yourself to kind of bring yourself together.
Well, it was important to me. I know that it was really important to feel part of something. And then I wished I could see these people all the time. Now that I'm old, I'm like, thank God I don't have to spend any time with these people. It's nice to be alone. But
surely you don't mean that, Seth.
I do. but anyhow, getting back to those days, like, basically, the British small press sort of fizzled out in, I guess, the early 90s.
I don't know whether it fizzled out or not, because I wasn't really in contact with it.
So yeah.
After a while, because it got to the early mid 90s, and it didn't seem that it was fizzling out at the time. It was just kind of carrying on in a different way. But when things are happening, you don't necessarily spot that they're happening until later. You think, oh yeah.
Yeah. No, it's funny. I talked about this many times, where I talk about how around the turn of like 1999 and 2000, it felt like comics themselves were dying. And then somehow or other, everything changed, and it feels now like the whole world of comics is entirely different.
Yes.
But sometimes you don't really see what's happening at the time, like you say.
It's very difficult to have the perspective when you're in it, isn't it?
Yeah. But when that, like when Escape Magazine went under and things like that, it seemed like you kind of dropped off the map of comics. Were you still... What was your thinking at that point?
Well, we carried on, because what happened, why the comics stopped, was because we were distributed by Titan Distributors, and then they were taken over by Diamond, but unfortunately Diamond didn't want to know about independent comics.
Okay.
And so we didn't have the distribution, so we couldn't carry on the comic anymore. But we did carry on in other ways. We held exhibitions of artwork.
Okay.
In venues, in galleries, in
like you were hanging
things.
Comic pages on
yeah,
the wall?
Yeah, okay. Because we had a nice set of frames, about 30 of them, with glass fronts, and we could just hang them up in these various places. We'd do new stories for that.
Okay, obviously, that's interesting.
There's no permanent record of that.
No.
And I did some Japanese comics, and I did the odd comic when somebody would say, can you do a story for this, a story for that?
Yeah.
Very occasionally.
And then eventually you started publishing things through, whatever that thing online is where you can...
Kindle and Smashwords.
Because I know you wrote a couple of novels. I bought them online, and I read them, and they were very Mauritania-like.
Yeah.
I quite enjoyed them. Was that... I guess my question is, after, from the 90s on, have you just basically been trying to express yourself in manners that don't necessarily have to be with comics?
Yeah, because I had a period where I did some paintings.
Oh, did you?
Okay. I mentioned Paul Harvey was a member of this Stuckist painting group. He said, Chris, come and do some paintings. I thought, well, yeah. Paul said, come and do some comics. I'll come and do some painting. But I didn't really have the interest to persist in the face of the difficulties of the paintings. So that didn't really last very long.
It's a tough world, the art world, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, Paul Harvey, you've mentioned him several times, is obviously like a creative spark in your life.
Yes.
How did you know each other? Like, what's the friendship?
Well, we became friends at college. We kind of immediately understood each other, and we got a lot out of our friendship. And I mean, we don't live in the same town anymore, unfortunately.
I remember. Yeah, it's funny that he's the guy who started Mauritania, because, and I don't mean this as an insult, but the comics. I always thought of him as kind of your friend in the comic, and I kind of forgot about him as being even in the comic.
Yeah.
When I wrote that appreciation of Mauritania afterwards, I think you sent me a message and you said something in there about, like, and Paul Harvey was in there too. And then I thought to myself, oh, geez, that was really asshole-ish. I wrote whole thing about this.
No, it wasn't.
And I never even mentioned his name.
But, I mean, we had Carol Swain, Phil Leskey, Trev Sleenix.
They just felt like guests in the book, I felt
I shouldn't have done, because... But
I just mean, like, that was my impression when I read them, is I always had this feeling like, oh, they asked Carol Swain to do a comic. I never thought of it in any way as an anthology. Your work had a very powerful presence, and I think you on almost every cover?
No, Paul Harvey did many of the covers, and Phil Leskey did a couple of them.
Okay. Yeah. Poor Paul, I keep not noticing. Well, there's a question. That particular group of artists you're talking about, Carol Swain, Phil Leskey, were they, like, I know that they were part of the escape group as well, but I don't think of them as being like, I think of them as being a little later into the game. Like they didn't, am I right or wrong about that?
Because me and Paul were kind of started the comic and they came along a couple of years later. Phil Lasky had been doing things earlier for Escape and didn't join Mauritania till.
You wrote some stuff for him to draw, didn't
that's
you?
That's right, yeah, called The Dolphin.
Yeah. I think I saw one issue of that, and that did not feel like your work at all.
Well, I don't always want to be doing the same thing.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's funny. It's like I feel like artists, like they're so... it's like it's hard, you know, but even when a cartoonist writes for somebody else, I often feel like I can still be like, oh yeah, well that's Dan Clowes writing for somebody else. That one really felt like it felt atypical for you.
Yeah.
It was an interesting work, though. Did you ever finish that?
Yes, and we brought it out as a separate comic, A5 size.
Oh, okay. This is the thing about the distribution back in the 80s. It's like, the fact that I even know about that is kind of a miracle because, you know, you just chance upon anything from Europe or... I mean, we were lucky to have good distribution here in Canada of the American stuff. We rarely saw anything from Europe or until people started translating. Obviously, you don't have to translate from England. Anyhow, though, are you still drawing comics?
Yes, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't draw them the same way. I don't draw on paper. I do quite rough sketches and tidy them up in Photoshop and assemble on layers.
Okay.
It's all computer done these days.
And is it still working with the same characters?
Yes.
I've kind of steered away from the characters because I don't want to spoil any of the mystery of the story by asking you what's going on in anything. But I do wonder, like, where Monitor comes from. He's a strange character to just have a guy with a helmet appear and wandering around, like from page one, basically.
Well, in your appreciation, you talk about Monitor a bit and you say it's as though he's a character that Chris thought of earlier and slotted into these comics. And I thought, Seth's right again. How did he know that?
So was it a childhood character or a teen?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've often thought of doing that myself, but my characters from when I was young are really dumb. And I don't think I could manage to fit them into anything. But it's funny, though, that you saw that as like a device of some kind, a way to tell a story without revealing what's going on.
Wearing his helmet, he can be the one that goes through the landscape and experiences the things. And because he's not a straightforward character, what he experiences doesn't have to be straightforward either, perhaps.
It's interesting that my wife was reading the book just recently, and she was saying how she found it very interesting that like things would happen to Monitor, and then in the next story it was like they were not referenced. It was like you were starting fresh again. Were you doing that on purpose? Well, like for example, Monitor gets his house and he's going to stay there.
I was saying to Aaron yesterday, my focus is on the individual stories rather than the continuity between the stories. So anything that's happened in previous stories, okay, it might stay the same, but if the story's going to be better without it, I'm going to drop it.
That's interesting. I feel that, like, I don't know about you, but growing up reading mainstream comics, it was so put into your head
that, you would
that
have
everything had to make sense.
Yeah.
People had spent lifetimes explaining away something that happened 50 issues ago.
Yeah.
That continuity, I think, it's like, it's rare to see somebody just throw it away.
Yeah, and I've other times deliberately thrown it away, because in some stories, the stories are not actually internally consistent.
Mm-hmm. I like that element of them. It adds to the mystery of, you know, the experience of reading them. Did you read, like, regular mainstream comics as a child?
Yeah, I read Batman comics, read British comics, United States Underground comics.
Oh, yeah.
And American Splendor.
Oh, yes, that's right. You've mentioned, I was reading an interview with you in the Herald, the Scottish Herald, and you mentioned... You mentioned Harvey Pekar several times.
Yes.
Was that something that really struck you at the
time? I just love those comics, the Harvey Pekar, American Splendors, yes.
They were great. I mean, I found them.
And again,
really
Paul Harvey found them and said, Chris, look at these.
Yeah, that stuff was really remarkable at the time, because even though people were doing, like, even though Crumb, for example, was doing stories based on his own life, there was never anything that mundane. When Crumb was drawing Harvey Pekar stories, it made you realize
really
the Crumb
strong
stuff was big.
Yeah. But I liked the other Harvey Pekar artists, like Gary Dunn and so forth, with the more kind of workmanlike style.
They were very workmanlike. Yeah, yeah. Yes, in fact, it took me a while to appreciate them.
No, lovely stuff.
Do you still read comics?
Not really, no. Not really read them.
I must say that this is an inevitable experience as you get older as a cartoonist, is that you read less comics. When I was young and I met Kim Deitch, I remember the first time and I was talking to him, and as I was talking to him, I realized, Kim doesn't really know what's going on anymore. And I thought to myself, like, I will never be that old cartoonist. But you know, it does happen.
It does, unfortunately, yeah.
You find that...
It's like we were talking about before, about the places that have influenced me, and the childhood places. Where I live now, Bournemouth, hasn't really influenced me because my influencing is already full, as it were. So perhaps, as an old cartoonist, we're already full of cartoonists, and it's no space for any more, perhaps.
It's true that it's harder to take in fresh influences as you get older. I do think that maybe it has something to do with like the drive of youth to prove yourself too, that you're very open to ideas.
Yeah.
I find that you get more set in your ways as you get older.
Naturally, because the age I am now, it takes me about four times as long to do anything as it would that I would have done when I was 20, so I'd do it better, but it'd take me longer.
Okay, now I was going to ask you some other questions here. How are we doing for time? Oh, we're good. Okay. Now, this was a question here. Are you actually interested in science fiction, or was that just sort of like a device?
It's a device.
Yeah.
I've read science fiction, like Philip K. Dick, I like Cordwainer Smith, like Asimov.
Okay. Were you interested in film science fiction, or what kind of film did you like?
I was in my 20s. I loved Blade Runner.
Yeah.
On the plane over, I tried the new Blade Runner, but it's the same thing.
Yeah. No, I love Blade Runner. I think I saw it 17 times back in the 80s, but I don't ever want to see that again.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was
It was fantastic.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah. But I kind of had a feeling that you weren't like a huge science fiction fan.
No, I'm not.
Did you like Tarkovsky?
Yes, I did. I liked Stalker.
Yeah. I kind of had a feeling you might like him, because there's also in his the works of science fiction he's done, there's that mystery underneath the surface.
Yeah, and Solaris, obviously, which is... I saw that on a very small black and white television. It seemed fantastic. When I saw it on a big screen later, it was good.
Yeah, it's funny how watching things on television actually was... talking about mystery again, there was a quality of when you chanced upon something in the old broadcast era...
Yeah.
That it was like a miraculous thing where you just found something.
I just saw it on BBC Two late at night, and I thought, what's this? This is fantastic. And I just had to stay up and watch it. You know?
Sometimes seeing things on the big screen when you're used, it takes a bit of the mystery out of something like that.
Because in this kind of cell where they are, where the rocket takes off, it looked all glass and heavy and Soviet on the telly. But on the big screen, you realise they've made it out of Perspex, and it was just a set.
That long sequence where the car drives through, like the land, through the, just on the highways, must have been great on a small TV, because it must have been constantly like, "What is going? Why? When is this going to end?"
Well, I wasn't thinking that. I was thinking, "Yeah, this is an art film. This is going to be really good."
Yeah, I remember back in the early '80s, I would watch the CBC used to have this late night movie where it just came on, and you at midnight or whatever, you watch it, and I never knew what was going to be on it. And I swear I must have saw like the greatest films for like about 6 months, where just every time you turned on, there was something amazing.
Yeah.
The one for me that I always remember was watching Gold Diggers of 1935, I think it is, the Busby Berkeley, where they have the Lullaby of Broadway sequence. And that was, I literally felt like, you know, you're 22 years old, you don't know what this is, and then this incredible, surrealistic sequence comes up. It's like you'd taken a hit of acid or something. The next morning you're like, did I really see that in the middle of the night? That was really that still is an amazing piece of work.
Yes,
but I digress. About the novels that you wrote,
yes,
is that something you're still pursuing?
No, because I think that at the time I was looking for a quicker way of doing stories and comics. But I think the novels were not as successful as the comics, because they
Are they still in print? Like, can you still purchase them?
I think there was.
What were the names? Cellarhead?
Cellarhead. And House of the Moon Queen.
Okay.
And I've since redone House of the Moon Queen as a comic.
Oh, really? That's a pretty big book.
Like. Well, I've selected certain elements and abandoned a lot.
Okay.
But, yeah, I think I've still got Cellarhead available.
I was going to say, I liked them. I did. But I was thinking, for what that idea of wanting to come up with a simpler method is like the cartoonist's dream.
Yeah.
Every cartoonist, like, at some point gets frustrated with how slow and difficult and laborious the medium is.
That's why I tried to make films. I thought it'd be easier.
I think that's always the thing, is that, I know that even now I've considered, like, maybe I could get somebody else to draw them.
Yeah, I've often thought that if I had a slave who could draw exactly how I want to draw it.
I'm starting to think it's okay even if they can't draw that well, just so I don't have to draw it. But here's a question for you, though, is that, wanting to write the novels as make it easier or whatever, ultimately, is that because you don't really enjoy drawing, or do you enjoy drawing?
A bit of both. I quite like drawing, but if I've got a page to throw, I'm thinking I don't really want to be doing this today.
Do you draw for pleasure? No. Like, do you ever just sit down and draw a picture?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I just draw because I've got something I want to put in the
comic.
So
it's goal-oriented. I want to do this specific thing.
I know people who do draw. They start drawing. Like, how do they do that? You know, it's so hard.
Yeah. No, I know. I do think there is a distinction between people who draw purely for pleasure and then people who do it more goal-oriented.
Yeah.
A lot of cartoonists are pretty goal-oriented, which is like, you know, they may keep a sketchbook, but even that is kind of like a fraud in that the sketches are, you know, they're making a book.
Yeah.
They're not. When you see somebody who really keeps a sketchbook, you often see someone who likes to draw.
Yeah.
You can see the pleasure in the drawing. I don't really enjoy drawing that much either. So I do understand. But I guess the thing is, and this would be the bigger question, why are either of us cartoonists if we don't like to draw?
Because it's the best way of presenting the story. Because unlike a text novel, you don't have to do description, and you can get your description spot on exactly the way you want it. You can be as mad as you like, but the pictures will hold the whole thing together and keep the reader confident in what's happening.
Do you feel confident that you can get, like, what you're drawing is what you want to, like, when you say you can get the details right? I guess my question is, like, when you're drawing something, does it actually reflect the world you're imagining? Or is it an impression of that, or what would you call it? I often feel like I'm trying to draw a realistic story, but my drawings are not realistic. So I'm creating a different world.
It's a difficult question, because often it's expedient. How can I do this, and I'm not going to spend all day on it? And you think that'll do.
I do think cartooning was created by a bunch of people who didn't want to spend a lot of time drawing.
Yeah.
I think they invented a medium that was pretty crappy, that, like, you know, I will do some doodles and put them in the newspaper and, you know, if not meant to be sweated over. And then somewhere along the line, a bunch of guys ruined it for us by getting too good. Because that pleasure of the expediency, and cartooning is a bunch of symbols, it's very simple, gets ruined when you get very fetishistic about it. But cartoonists tend to sweat out things, you know, like where you get too concerned with what things look like.
But as long as you know, he's over there, she's over there, I want this one in the foreground, and you'll see the mountain in the distance. You can get that and have a reasonably attractive-looking drawing of it. That's fair enough.
Well, your work's really graphic, too. I really feel like, actually, the images have stopped. Is there any way to get those just rotating behind us again?
He's gone out of
there. Oh, he's gone. Well, it ain't going to happen then. Your work is very graphic. Like, in fact, it feels more like design in a way sometimes than drawing. Were you really aware of designing a page as a page, or were you just plugging along panel by panel?
Plugging along panel by panel. I've done some designing for page, but it doesn't come naturally. I'm just trying it.
Because I would say the pages seem really logically designed.
Well, you'll notice that the stories all fit into the 9-panel grid very well.
Yeah.
And so they are designed in that sense.
Yeah, well, I do think it's interesting that, like, much like we were talking earlier about how you can put things into a work and not be aware of, like, a clever connection, I do think that a lot of times you can do that with drawing as well, that you're making, wonderful like connections between things. Like, look at these three silhouettes in here, for example, or four silhouettes. It's like that balances the page so beautifully.
Accident.
Just an accident, yeah. You know, I've always impressed, actually, you know, just working on designing your book recently, I was noticing how often you would just use a silhouette,
yeah,
which is like a great device.
But you don't want to hold people up looking at the drawing, do you? Carry on.
Yeah, and the drawing, and it's funny how, I think when I was, definitely when I was younger, I had this feeling like you had to, every time you used a device like a silhouette, it was a cheat. So it was like you didn't put in the work. Because you were supposed to draw the whole face or whatever.
Yeah.
But interestingly, it makes the page so much lighter and freer when you don't over-render everything.
Yeah, it does. Because otherwise people are going to slow down and look at the scenery, aren't they?
Yeah. Which is actually the next question I was going to ask you is, there is a lot of scenery in your work. Landscape seems really important.
It is. Because what I'm... was originally trying to do with these comics, I think, and with my art in general, is to kind of preserve feelings and a sense of place and that kind of thing. And so I put those things in.
Yeah. You see, you mentioned then when you said things you like to do, you mentioned you like walking, like going out. So do you feel really connected to the outdoors?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Not necessarily the countryside, but walking around the towns and things.
Yeah. Have you walked around Toronto at all since you've
been
here?
I have, and it's lovely, and I like the streetcars, and I've been on the subway, and I like all those wires. And
the city has really changed here,
I can
tell you.
The wheels and the things, yeah.
And I think you would have liked it here when I arrived back in 1980. It had
more
of that failed industrial quality. That you
liked. Yeah.
I must admit, when I was walking around the city yesterday, too, and I was perplexed at how different everything was in the last... since I moved out away from here almost 20 years ago now, the city has really changed.
Yeah.
Is the city you live in now, you mentioned it was very touristy, does it have like the any of the industrial quality that your work expresses?
It does in a few places, but you tend not to see those places.
Yeah.
Because it was built, Bournemouth and Poole, which are two towns together. Poole's a port city and it's got more industry than Bournemouth. But it was built or grew up in the days when industry and housing would coexist. They wouldn't be zoned apart. So it's interesting in that way.
Yeah, it's true. I never really thought about that. But yeah, people would... when you look at the design of old cities, there's always area... the industrial areas are also residential.
Yeah.
Because the workers live there close by. And that's not really... I mean, the area I live in Guelph, which is a little city not far from here, it's called the Ward, and that's exactly what it was. It was where the workers lived. Now, what were your parents like?
They're still alive. They're lovely.
Are they?
Yeah.
Okay. What did your parents do?
They were both teachers.
Oh, really? Okay, that's interesting.
My father taught the classics and Latin and Greek, and my mum taught art.
That sounds so British. Did you feel like you got a good education?
Yes, I did. I thought I'd have... very good one. I wouldn't have been able to escape it with parents like that.
Did you go to, what kind of a school did you attend? It wasn't one school where you had to go away from home, was
it? No, it was the local comprehensive at which my dad taught, so I had to behave myself as well.
Oh, really? Yeah. That must have been unpleasant to be where your father was a teacher.
Well,
did you feel like, I don't want to get into your psychology, but... So they're still alive then?
Yes, they are, yes.
Oh, that's nice. And are they still in Wales?
They are, yes.
Do you go back to Wales often?
Not often enough.
Do you feel connected to the Welsh culture?
I never did when I lived there. I always wanted to impose my own ideas on the place rather than accept what was already there.
Okay.
But these days I'm feeling more lenient towards it and thinking, yeah, it's all right, all the Welsh culture.
Did you feel more connected to the English culture when
you were young? Yeah, I did, yeah.
Was that because of the media, because of all the TV and publications and stuff?
I don't know why it was. Perhaps it's because my parents were both English as well. And they moved to Wales independently during the war and they met there.
I'm always surprised when I meet someone from a culture that is kind of the more dominated culture, where they don't necessarily have, where they don't necessarily sympathize with their own group, essentially.
I do more now.
Yeah. I have a couple of French-Canadian friends who are, really love England, and they're real Anglophiles, and I'm like, what? Like, I thought if you're from Quebec, you're supposed to be like, you know, totally against the English language. So it's always that always throws me for a loop. But so what was it in your upbringing, do you think, that made you want to feel rebellious about that?
I didn't really feel rebellious. It was just, and if I was rebellious, it was a very quiet rebellion. It was just what I was interested in. I was more interested in my things rather than the kind of existing culture around me.
Was your dad, were your parents kind of highbrows?
Not really, no.
No, okay, because I'm wondering, you know, if they were teachers and then you were interested in comics. Comics is all, especially back then, was considered pretty low.
Not by them, but they would happily buy me comics.
And that's nice.
And then my dad would read them as well.
Okay. No, it's a very common story among cartoonists that their parents were opposed to them.
Not at all, no. I was encouraged by my comics and my grandparents would buy me comics.
Did you think you had a good childhood? Were you a happy child?
Yeah, it was great, I wasn't a particularly happy child, but I didn't really have anything to moan about.
Okay, that's another well-adjusted cartoon. Okay, anyhow though, what are we doing for time here? I think, should we open up and ask anyone to ask some questions?
Okay.
Can I do that? Would anyone like to ask a question? Chester?
I'm curious, you said you lived with a bunch of other cartoonists at some point.
Yeah. I lived with Ed Pinsent and various other cartoonists in the Fast Fiction and Escape community.
Yeah. How did that come about?
Well, because there was a rented house, and when a room became available, they'd say, come and live in our house.
Yeah. Did you enjoy living with the other artists?
It was all right, yeah. I didn't know any different.
Was it inspiring in any way? Like, did people encourage each other to work?
Yeah, but it was mainly just we knew each other, so we might as well live in the same house. Yeah,
I mean, I was very gratified to meet Chester and Joe Matt when I was a younger cartoonist, because it was nice to have some people around who would inspire you and critique your work and stuff, but I sure wouldn't have wanted to live with them.
Well, it was all right. You know.
Yeah. Anyone else with a question? Sure.
For not liking to draw so much, does the computer make it easier?
Much easier, yes, because I can pre-produce or reuse things and just assemble the pictures from them. And
do you feel any guilt using drawings like from something else?
Not at all, no. Because
I like the idea.
Because I'm thinking, I'm going to do this story. Well, after the material in the New World book, I more or less drew a line under that. I said, right, that's all done. I'm going to start comics again now.
Okay.
And with this, with Kindle and using the computer, and I was ill a bit, so I found I couldn't really do the drawing, do the lettering specifically so easily anymore. I thought, I'm just going to do them like this from now on, because I've finished that part, I'm going to start all over again and do them differently.
Well, it does seem, I must say, when computers came along, I was very resistant to them.
Yeah.
To the point where, like, it got to the point now where it's too late for me. Like, I realized I probably made a mistake. I should have learned how to use Photoshop. But in some ways, I feel like I've been freed from the computer.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it does sound very desirable, the idea of, like, making a stock group of images.
Yeah.
And being also able to build comics out of them.
And it's this thing, it's like your rubber stamps.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like having an art slave again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It can be drawn.
Yeah. No, that does sound appealing. Any other questions? Sure, Peter?
You mentioned briefly doing some Japanese comics. Could you elaborate on what that was and how that came about?
It was a fellow called Pierre Alain Zigaty, and it was to do with the EU, the European Union, and he worked as a kind of liaison man for Kodansha, a Japanese publisher, who produce Morning. And they had a series of European comics run in Morning magazine, and I was one of the artists.
Were you among the ones who went to Japan as part of that?
I never went to Japan, no.
Jack, sure.
The new book, does it contain any of the comics that you drew on the computer, or is that all hand-drawn stuff?
It's all hand-drawn.
Sure, over there.
Can you talk a little bit about how nostalgia plays in your work? I noticed when we talked yesterday, you talked about your grandmother and people that you used to know.
Yes.
You know, can you talk a little bit about that sort of wistful quality that your works need to have?
Well, as I was saying before, it's about one of the reasons I draw these comics is to try and preserve feelings and impressions of places. And so it's kind of natural that I put loved people or impressions of loved people or characters based in some way on loved people in them. And so I've done that. Yes.
Yeah, I guess that's something I'm ashamed I didn't think to bring up nostalgia. But I was going to say that there is a wistful quality in the work, and I did suspect that a lot of what that the work is more personal than it appears.
Yeah.
So,
it's perhaps personal, but not identified as such.
Yeah.
You know, specifically personal in places.
Often it's the most freeing way to do things, too, because something about direct autobiography actually is kind of limiting. It's like you think too hard about what you're trying to say. But the work is very emotional.
Yeah.
It's like I can feel that underneath it. But about it, are you actually? I wouldn't say the word itself is nostalgic. Do you feel nostalgic though when you read your own comics again for the past?
No, because they're comics that I did. So I tend to see them in a technical way.
Okay.
And criticize my lettering and think, does that run properly? And I'm trying to rewrite it.
So in a way, is that like a failure, an artistic failure that all artists have where they're, I feel this myself, where you create the work because you want to preserve something, like feelings, or you want to infuse it with the emotions you feel, but then when you reread your own work, it doesn't do that for you.
I found that out a long time ago.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I've always sort of known
it's still worth the effort.
Yeah, you still keep trying to do it, though. Well, I guess we'll take one more question before we... Or maybe we've got a few minutes, but we should probably let some time for the people to set up like they did for us. But let's see if there's another question out there. Sure.
I'm interested about what you're saying about nostalgia, and also sense reference to the look of your comics. Do you feel that the look of your comics relates to your association with nostalgia, or nostalgia for a specific art style from your childhood?
Well, one of the reasons for the black and white is the look of old black and white films. And so there's a certain... Because it's like we were talking about the telly. When you see an old film on the telly, a black and white film, particularly on a black and white telly years ago, it would seem so far away, even though the film might have been actually comparatively recent. And so I think there's something of that kind of feel that I've wanted to put in it, in the stories.
Yeah, the work, it does... I hadn't thought about it, but I suppose... Is it an old-fashioned style? Like, does it, and the world is presenting does look like the old world to me. Like, looks like a pre-1960s world, sometime from the 50s back. But I never actually thought, looking at it, of whether it's actually the style itself. Do you think it feels contemporary, or do you think it feels of another period?
I think it feels like a 1950s style.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you consciously thinking about that at all? I mean, I can see the film reference you're just talking about, too.
Probably, I probably would have been doing that consciously, yes.
Okay.
But this is a long time ago we're talking about it.
Yeah, it's funny how you make conscious decisions and then time goes by and you forget them.
Yeah.
And it's like, when I was starting out, I deliberately wanted to draw in an old-fashioned style. And I studied old cartoonists and I learned to ink like the New Yorker cartoonists or whatever. And then years went by and I forgot I'd done that. And you just get used to your own style and then... You draw something and people are like, oh, that's so nice, it's so old-fashioned looking. And then you think like, oh, yeah, I guess it is.
Yeah.
Because you've forgotten all the decisions you made that led you down that path. That's just how you draw.
Yeah.
Shall we take one more and then wrap it up? Is there anyone else got a question? Sure, Peter?
Could you speak briefly about the experience of having the book come out from Penguin at a time, the Martini collection at a time when there wasn't really much in the way of books like that being published?
Well, it kind of came out of nowhere. I think that probably Paul Gravett had something to do with it, as he operates in the background promoting cartoonists quite often, very often. And Penguin got in touch with me and said, would you like to do a graphic novel for us? And I said, yes, of course I would. And than I did.
Did they edit you at all?
There were a couple of little spelling errors that they spotted, but it was very minimal editing.
So they didn't you just presented them with the finished book?
I did a script first.
Okay.
And because all this old material, I always did a script first. And so I gave them that, and they said, yes, this is all right, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was no other graphic novels from Penguin in that line, was there?
There was a Matati.
Okay.
There were a few of them, but this was the only originally commissioned one. The others were bought in. Yeah.
And I didn't get the impression that that line went over well. What happened?
I think they were just testing the water.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was probably too early.
Well, you wouldn't know in those days that it was too early, would you?
Yeah. I mean, what year did that come out?
In 1990.
Okay. Oh God. Yeah. That was too early.
Now we know.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess we should. That's about right timing. We should probably stop. But I'd just like to say thank you. And
thank you very much, everyone.